So the Dalai Lama was born in, I think it was 1936, in a little peasant hut, a little farming hut, in the mountains of northeastern Tibet or far western China, depending upon how you want to slice that particular pie. And he was discovered by a party of traveling monks who were actually looking for him, and then taken to Lhasa in south central Tibet, where he was given a phenomenally good education in the Buddhist sense. And in 1959, he fled Tibet after 8 or 9 years of Chinese occupation of his country. Same time as the Chinese were spreading into Korea, into North Korea, which led to the Korean War, they also moved into Tibet to take over Tibet, and they also moved into an area called Sichuan, north of Tibet. And the only reason that the Korean War was not the Tibetan War, because the State Department thought about it, was they decided they could get supplies and soldiers to Korea by ship, but they couldn't get them to Tibet any other way than by airplane. So that's the reason the United States never had a war in Tibet, except a covert war. He's called the 14th Dalai Lama. If you were a Tibetan, the way you would think about this is not that there have been 14 Dalai Lamas, but there's been one Dalai Lama with 14 bodies. Now, why would a culture have an institution like this? Because he was the head of the government. It was a theocracy until it ended in the 1950s. Why would a country be a theocracy, and why would it have a government in which it believed that the head of state was a person who came back 14 times and was the head of state 14 times? Why would you believe that you could search your entire country for a little child and having in some way identified who that little child was, who was the rebirth of the last head of state, take that child and train it to be the next head of state. Give it the best possible education you can and make the next head of state. And he's head of state for a lifetime. He can't actually exactly resign because he's born into the job. He can't abdicate like being a king. He can stop doing the job, but it doesn't change his condition of being Dalai Lama. So let me just speak to this for a few minutes, because relevant to the question of who this person is and the theology that he speaks to. Because his experience, because of his prominence in the world, is such that he's met all the major religious leaders in the world. He's had the opportunity to talk to popes, cardinals, heads of all the major religious traditions in the world, visit most of the major religious sites in the world, pray and meditate with people, all this kind of stuff, and talk to them about their own personal experience, their own religious experience. And what he has to say about religious pluralism at this point in his life, because he's in his 70s, comes out of that experience. So it's an informed experience. And he's a very sophisticated and intelligent person. So for example, if you go to one of his public talks now, you'll hear him say things like, faith that is not founded on analytical reasoning and investigation is useless. Don't waste your time. Analyze religious issues, analyze all issues using your good intelligence, and be sure you get a good education before you try and do this. And on the basis of good analytical investigation and scientific investigation, if the philosophy of your religion makes sense to you, then follow it. And if it doesn't, throw it out. And although he travels all over the world and meets people and teaches all over the world, the first thing he says all the time is, from my point of view, you should stick with whatever religion you were born into. It makes a whole lot more sense. So if you're Catholic, I'm here as a Buddhist talking to you, but I think it makes more sense that you should stick with your own Catholicism. The other thing he says, which is very unusual, is if there's anything in science which disproves any tenets of your own religion, then you should throw out the tenets of your own religion. Now, that's not exactly standard operating procedure for major religious leaders to say things like that. So what kind of person is this? Where does he come from? Why was he the head of state? And so on and so forth. So I'm going to just speak briefly about that, because this is not a class in Buddhism. But it's useful to know where this guy comes from and why he has his point of view. So for starters, Tibet was a Buddhist country. And that means that about 2,500 years ago, Buddha was around, and he had many things to say about the human condition, but one of the things that were actually at variance with established teachings in India at the time, but one of the things he did not disagree with was the doctrine of reincarnation. And generally speaking, the doctrine of reincarnation is interpreted as within you there is something which is like a soul, and when the body dies, that soul takes on a new body, which might or might not be a human body. But the point is that it can't be destroyed. Now, Buddhists don't happen to believe in a soul. They don't actually believe that the person sitting and talking with them, like this person, me, David, actually even exists in the way in which we think it exists. They say that each of us thinks of ourselves as a solid, independent, absolute entity, an ego, as we would say in English. But Buddhists say if you actually analyze very closely and try to find that solid, independent entity, which is the you that you say you are, you can't find it. In the end, I'll cut through a whole lot of philosophy, they say what you call me, I, the subject of experience, the actor in your life, is a mere label on a very complicated concatenation of elements of mind and body with a label I or me, and that's what a person is and nothing more than that. And so the question always comes up, if that's the case, what is it that's reborn? Because the Buddha said rebirth is the case. And the Buddhist answer to that is they believe that the consciousness is something that can be neither created nor destroyed, so it has continuity. That the subtle consciousness within each of us that's aware can neither be created nor destroyed. It changes, it's impermanent, but it cannot be absolutely destroyed, nor was there any point that you can identify when it was created. The consequence of that is it always exists, is really what they're saying. And if it always exists, it always exists in an embodied form. Although they don't say necessarily in a materially embodied form, they also believe in unmaterial embodied forms. That's not really the main point. The main point is that what Buddhists believe is that your consciousness has a continuity, and when you die, it's going to find another body. So, because it also changes and is associated with habit patterns of greater or lesser sophistication, this is the impact of our life experience. I mean, some people say, for example, who believe in reincarnation, we've come to this planet to learn things. And we go from life to life learning things, and that's the whole point of it. We go from life to life learning things, and hopefully we're improving our situation. Americans say that because Americans believe in progress. Nobody else in the world interprets reincarnation in that way that I'm aware of. Maybe some Europeans. But Buddhists believe that from life to life you do acquire habits which can either be positive or negative or better or worse. But you can also acquire habits of intelligence and habits of good perception and habits of a good analysis and habits of clarity of mind. So the Buddhist path, as Buddhists understand it, is about acquiring those positive habits as you go from life to life. Finally getting smart enough so you can extract yourself from this mess. And that's the whole point. Okay. Unless you'd make a contrary decision, which is rather than just extracting yourself from this mess, you decide that you want to help out. and help out all the people who are stuck in this mess. So instead of extracting yourself from this mess, you use your good habits of mind to help other people. And so that brings us to the whole concept of the Dalai Lama. So Buddhism came to Tibet in originally in the 7th century, and then it sort of faded out after a couple hundred years, and then it kind of got reestablished again in the 11th century and pretty much began to cover the whole of Tibet at that point. And by one way of counting the demographics, in the early 20th century anyway, exactly, in the early 20th century anyway, a third of the population of Tibet lived in monasteries or nunneries. So Buddhism was pretty firmly established in Tibet in that form. Yeah.
What was in Tibet before Buddhism?
Shamanistic type religions.
Just generic
shamanism? No, unique shamanism, but that's not really a subject for today's talk. Catch me after class and I'll talk to you about it. Yeah. They had its own particular version of shamanism called Pan, spelled in English B-O-N, pronounced Pan, like more like a P. It was a unique form of shamanism to that part of the world, and I'll talk to you about it if you want. Okay, so the main thing is, imagine now a plateau in Central Asia where the lowest, most fertile part of the country is at altitude 12,000 feet. That's the lowlands, 12,000 feet. Anybody ever been on a 12,000 foot mountain? I've been up to 10,000 feet outside of Santa Fe. 12,000 feet, lowlands. It goes up from there, okay? Goes up from there. Not a lot grows there. Grass, few apricot trees. Not a lot of farming you can be successful with there. Barley, apricots, can't grow wheat, can't grow rice. Not a lot of people because of that. A lot of mountains, which means a lot of people living in valleys separated by mountains. So it's a geography which tends toward isolating people from each other. So you have dialects of Tibetan so that people on one part of the country can hardly understand people at the other part of another part of the country because the dialects are so different. Okay, so in this world, what ended up happening was because it was a Buddhist world, and because Buddhists at this particular point lived in nunneries and monasteries to a great extent, the nunneries and monasteries became centers of culture in these isolated valleys around Tibet. And they were somewhat disconnected from each other. Now, how do you govern in this part of the world? Traditionally, there might be kings or something like that, but if economic power is sort of centered in the monasteries, and wealth is sort of centered in the monasteries, then the leadership of the monasteries from time to time, from generation to generation, becomes very important. So the original thing that the Tibetans struck on as a solution to the problem of political continuity was the nephew of every abbot of a monastery would become the next abbot of a monastery, because monks are celibate. They don't get married, so they don't have children. So unlike a kingship, you can't pass the head of the organization, you can't pass the position of head of the organization onto your son or your daughter if it's a nunnery. So how do you deal with it? Originally, the way they dealt with it was they passed it on to the nephews. So your brother, who wasn't a monk, would have a son, and your brother's son would take over the monastery. That system didn't work out real well. And then they struck on the idea, which is kind of unique, that wait a minute, if everybody who dies is reborn, then when the abbot of the monastery dies, he's going to get reborn. Well, let's go look for him. We just have the same guy run the show. So that was actually what the system became. Somebody dies, we'll go look for his next birth, and he will be the next abbot. So the abbots of monasteries then had lineal succession. So you have Karmapa 16. You have 16 abbots of this monastery. Theoretically, if you follow Buddhism, the same guy with 16 bodies. So the head of state in Tibet turned out to be the same process, and that was the Dalai Lama. 14 bodies, one person. Now, if we look at that from the point of view of sort of the theology of it as the Tibetans present it, that would seem a little dubious to us, I think, as Westerners, and we would think it's a little bit strange. But how about, okay, just a second, how about a political system where you have a bunch of really smart people scour the countryside, and they look for the smartest kids they can find, and they take the smartest kids they can find, and they give them the best education they can give them, and they say, okay, you're now in charge of the political system. Rather than who gets the most amount of money, gets the most TV time, gets the most votes, and goes to Congress and creates the kind of mess we have. Of course, they created their own messes as a result of that. I'm not saying that their system was the best system. Every system comes with its own version of mess. Their version of mess was a different version of mess. But one thing you could say about their system was it was run by really smart people who were very well educated and were trained from childhood for the job they have. So, I've watched the Dalai Lama. He's the best public speaker I've ever seen, even though he can barely speak English, really, when you get right down to it. I've watched him get up in front of 14,000 people, say at the arena in Portland last spring. What is that called, where the Trailblazers play in Portland?
The Rose Garden.
The Rose Garden. Watched him get up in front of 14,000 people, didn't break a sweat, was totally relaxed, had the governor of Oregon on one side of him, had one of the two senators from Oregon on the other side of him, having this conversation with 14,000 people in a totally informal way, and 10 minutes into the talk decided he was going to do something else entirely without any notes and totally changed direction in what he was doing. Totally charmed 14,000 people, was completely clear the entire time, and his native language is not completely clear in his thought process, the entire time, and his native language is not English, speaking on a subject as difficult as environmentalism. He was not talking about Buddhism, right? Holding his own with some very sophisticated scientists and politicians. Kitzhaber is not an unsophisticated politician. And bring down the house. And why can he do this? And he does it over and over again. He does it day after day, day after day, day after day. He was this last week, he was doing it at Emory University in Atlanta to large crowds. He got on a plane, he went down to Mexico City, and he did it for 3 days, day after day, to 14,000 people in crowds in Mexico City who speak Spanish. He doesn't speak Spanish, so it's all by translation. He does it day after day after day. So how is he able to do this? It's because he was raised and trained to be able to do this. When he took his final exam for the equivalent of his PhD, there were 6,000 people in the audience. And he was debating with the best debaters in Tibet, because that's part of the way they learn, they debate. He was debating with the best debaters in Tibet. And he just does it because he's trained to do it. So he is a leader who is trained to have incredible stage presence, be an incredible speaker, and to not be fazed by a crowd of people who would wither me if I was just to even walk in front of them, if I didn't even have to say anything. 14,000 people? Can you imagine having to stand up in front of 14,000 people and read a speech, even if you prepared it, let alone work from no notes? Okay. So, that's the world that he lives in, and he's met every major religious leader. Most major religious leaders, but certainly every major political leader. So that's a little kind of context or background about him, because when we actually get into reading what he has to say about religious pluralism, he comes from a very unique point of view, and that's really what I want to share with you. And you'd be surprised at what he has to say, because he is not in agreement with Hick, and he is not in agreement, definitely not in agreement with the Dalai Lama. But he comes closer to being in agreement with Eck, which is a little bit surprising, I think. Okay? So I hope you'll read some of the material that I gave you to look at over the weekend, so you'll have more of a of an informed way of thinking about what we'll talk about next week. And so we'll talk about the Dalai Lama for a while. I'm not sure how long we'll stick with that subject, and it may be the case that we move on. And the segue, and the reason that I present the Dalai Lama at this particular point, is what you're going to find is that he argues for the importance of science for understanding human nature and understanding human relations, and the importance of science for dealing with problems of religious pluralism. And so we're going to use that as a springboard to actually jump into looking at psychology as a science, which is going to address some underlying issues associated with world religious pluralism. And that's the theme that we're going to stick with for the rest of the class. That's really going to be the heart of the class then. Okay? All right, so I will be here tomorrow. And